today on Sticks In, we're going to whip around the lacrosse world a little bit, touch on a variety of topics. We had a trade in the PLL. We had some championship series roster moves that are coming we can talk about. We've got the Inside Lacrosse Top 50 that dropped that has people talking, so obviously we have some takes for you there. We have the NLL season underway, so we can touch on opening weekend quickly, and then we will also touch on the sad news about Lindenwood and the fact that they will be discontinuing their men's lacrosse program after this season. You might even just bring a little PLL Top 50 in there, too. I don't know. We'll see. We'll touch on that, maybe. Busy day. Lots to cover. Let's do it. Welcome back to the Sticks In podcast. Like I said there in the top, quite a bit of lacrosse news to talk about. Not a bad topic slate here for December the 4th when it comes to even the outdoor game and stuff. So let's just kind of get right into it. We'll start with the PLL, the pro team that's not in season, or the pro league that's not in season, where the news lately there, kind of the bigger pieces of news lately there, was a trade that happened. So if you missed it, or if you haven't seen it since, or you need a little refresher, the terms of that trade were: the Whipsnakes, the now Maryland Whipsnakes, received Matt Rees and a third-round pick in this year's draft and next year's draft, so the 2024 and 25 drafts, from the Boston Cannons in exchange for defenseman Bryce Young and two-way midfielder Connor Kirst. Just kind of go side by side of the thing here. So on the Whip side of things, obviously, they had some draft capital. To me, as I look at that deal, I see a trade that's about acquiring picks. For some context and as a kind of evidence that I think that might be the case, you might remember that the Whips did acquire Jackson Morrow last year near the end of the season, kind of as this extra little offensive piece, I think hoping for a playoff push that ultimately did not materialize for them. But they made that deal for Jackson Morrow in late August, like near the end of the regular season, because the trade deadline goes that way. And they dealt away their second round pick in this upcoming draft as part of that. And then they have a third round pick swap with the then Chrome, now Outlaws. So the Whips are going to pick third overall in the upcoming draft, but they do not have a second round pick. They dealt that in the Morrow deal. And then they pick swapped in the third round with the then Chrome, now Outlaws. So this is one of the reasons why I liked that deal for the Outlaws at the time. So with this deal, the Whips pick up another third-round pick this year. They get one next year, too. As pretty well documented by basically everyone at this point, it's a very deep draft this year, on the offensive end in particular. So, look, adding picks where you can get them literally anywhere in the draft is worthwhile. Like, the heavyweights at the top, the Whips are going to have the ability to draft one of Brennan O'Neill, Connor Schellenberger, or Pat Cavanaugh with the third pick. One of those three, just do the math, will be there. So, and then those two picks in the third round, you can still yield serious offensive or defensive talent there, because this draft is so top-heavy that it's going to push guys you might expect to be maybe late first-rounders into the middle of the second round, you know, guys you maybe thought would be a second-rounder into the third round. So the Whips acquiring the picks, to me, signals that they're starting to look to the future a little bit. They have some aging stars, you know, everybody kind of knows that. The Michael Earhart retirement speculation is going to be endless from now until the minute Michael Earhart himself says exactly what the plan is. But look, Mike Chanenchuk, free agent. Jake Bernhardt, free agent. Both those guys are a few years north of 30. Chanenchuk coaches at Stony Brook. Bernhardt just took the head coaching gig at Colby. You know, those are signs of where those guys' careers in the coaching world are heading. It's a good time to start kind of looking at getting younger and rebuilding the core of the team a little bit. But with that as kind of like the what the trade looks like is happening, the interesting thing to me is Bryce Young is 27. He has started every game the Whips have played. Literally every single one of them, unless I'm missing a postseason game or missed a random one here or there or something. But he started every game for them. there was all that talk all the time about how the Whips had the best defense, like, ever, right? They talked about their 2020 defense literally being the best defense ever and one of the best defensive units over their time that's ever been in the game. And Bryce Young has started every game on it. So it's a cornerstone piece to me. And like I said, he's still a few years away from 30. He's on the young side of things. To me, if I'm building a future, he's an obvious guy that I want to keep around. That said, as noted, the draft is very loaded. You can get good talent. And beyond the looking at it through the lens of, oh, well, the draft is loaded, I can replace Bryce Young that way, I'm going to say that, you know, I'm sure some of the thinking is that, but some of the thinking is also the draft is so loaded, picks ain't going to be cheap. If you're acquiring picks, you're going to have to pony up. Like Marlo Stanfield said, the price of the brick going up. This is the price of the pick going up here this year. You get it. If you're acquiring picks, you're going to have to part with guys that you maybe did not want to part with, you're not excited about parting with, or you wouldn't have to part with for picks in a different draft. So some of it, I'm sure, is the Whips thinking, we can get good picks in this, we can get good players in this draft. It's loaded. I know the offensive end gets the billing, but the defensive end has lots of really high-level players too. And some of it is, if you want to take some picks away from us in this draft with it this good, you're going to have to pay up. So I think the Whips paid up a little bit, giving up Bryce Young. I know I'm focused on him here. The other players in the deal, Connor Kearst going to Boston, Matt Rhys going to Maryland. Looking at what the Whips are getting back, Rhys is 30 years old, I believe now, is coming off a major knee injury. I think if the Whips are building for the future, it's okay for you to wonder if he's part of it or if this is the salary cap needs to work, the roster numbers need to work. So Rhys goes too. If nothing else, I think Rhys is a veteran guy who's going to be a leader in your locker room. You've got some young guys at the position, or the Whips are figuring they're going to have some young guys at the position. I think they'll definitely be looking to add a young LSM in this draft or free agency as a result of this deal, right? Earhart, even if he doesn't retire this year, you can tell it's getting near the end. Not because of his level of play, but just because of kind of the way he talked at the end of last season and kind of where he is in his life. You know, Rhys, we just talked about, you know, how much will he be able to give you at his age at 30 years old you got to see what he's like coming off of that knee injury. And that really just leaves you with Squires at that position. So, you have to, I think, expect there that either free agency or the draft, one of those picks that they got is going to be spent at the LSM spot, or that kind of, you know, those poles who are kind of flexed between two spots that are more in vogue now. So you get that for the Whips. Connor Kearst goes to Boston, is united with Colin, as Boston apparently is preparing to assemble some kind of Voltron of Kearst. Connor fits what Boston likes to do, I think, with their midfielders. He's kind of like another Bubba Fairman for them. Look, Connor played some midfield, played some attack at Villanova, played some midfield, played some attack at Rutgers, became kind of a two-way midfielder guy with the Whips, has now kind of skewed a little more towards the SSDM, the short stick D-middy side of things, where I think he's pretty good, right? He's not like an all-pro or anything, but he's good. He's an every-week player. And that's basically the same track Fairman traveled on in his time from Maryland to joining the PLL. So players like that who have that sort of career arc or that skill set and can move between those roles, those guys are always going to get a roster spot. They're so valuable. I say it all the time. There's 19 guys that play that suit up on game day. That's not a lot. Just 19 guys. If you have a player who effectively does for your team what another team might need two guys to do, or even three guys to do, that means you can dress more specialized weapons than they can, and that's an advantage. So when you get those guys, like Ian McKay is like the king of it, right? He can play O-Middy for the Chaos. He can play D-Middy. He can pick up a pole. He can shoot on Van Up for you. He can whatever. Like, because you have a player like him who does a million things, you don't have to dress as many guys that play those positions. You just dress him. So Kearst, I see as that type of player. Not like Kearst isn't picking up a pole or anything, but look, you need somebody to stay on, and because he can be a matchup problem as an offensive middie going D to O, he's good for that. If your offensive middies are short, you have an injury during the game, you need somebody to get more O-middie shifts, he's good for that. He can play out of an invert because he's played so much attack. It's the kind of guy that's just good to have because he fits so many spots. I'm not going to get into who won the trade and all that. I think most people at this point are kind of tired of that whole thing, and it's impossible to even evaluate who wins a trade. Number one, until you know all the players in it, there's two picks. One of them's not going to get made until two drafts from now that are on the move here. And you got to see who these guys are that get drafted, who the Whips get with those picks, and how they turn out as pros to really evaluate. But as of today, I like the Cannons' return for the picks they got. Bryce Young joins a core on defense that's got a lot of talent, a lot of young talent that's I think, really building some depth. And I think the coaching staff, you know, the entire staff for the Cannons last year, Coach Holman, but also like Coach Mitchell and Mikey Thompson with that defense, they really have an outstandingly schemed and well kind of organized unit. So it's Bryce Young gets to join that. You got to remember that the Cannons did add Cade Sostad last year after the draft and stashed him on the holdout list all summer. He's kind of easy to forget about because he just wasn't anyone's mind, but he's a Pole who had first or second round talent a year ago, even in last year's draft where we were ranting and raving about how good all the defenders were. Sostad's there with them, but he had a job out of college that, you know, didn't give him the opportunity to play PLL over the summer. But make no mistake, he is a pro. He is a stud. If he's available this summer, then the Cannons get to add Bryce Young, Cade Sostad, who knows who else. And they'll have one of the better and younger defenses around, right? You got Ethan Wall still running around. You got, you know, Max Wayne is a very young guy who gets to play for Mikey Thompson, who's his college coach. You got Cade Van Raphorst is turning into like your elder statesman on that team, right? So the young defensive group that the Cannons are building there, I think, is really, really great. I think the Whips, you know, obviously they get back Reese. Who knows what you get out of Reese? But really for them, I think it's getting those picks, and we'll see kind of what they do with them as the draft approaches. But on to the next thing here. Staying with the PLL, Championship Series roster moves. If you weren't clear on it, if a team isn't able to build a full 12-man roster for the Championship Series out of guys from their current 25, then the PLL lets that team add players from the player pool on what you basically would just call like a Championship Series contract. Basically, they're on the team for a week, and when it ends, they go back to the player pool. But, you know, all these teams have a guy who's, you know, he's in the NLL, he can't get off of work, he's got this, he's got that, it's tough, you know, getting away, traveling for a week away from his family, whatever it is. Just about everybody has a hard time getting to 12 that are good for the event out of their 25, so this exists for that. And we had a couple teams take advantage of it this week, or not this week, but, you know, of late, I guess. First, the Water Dogs added Jason Rose. Rose, if you don't remember, played at Air Force, was a goalie there. Dylan Ward is going to be with the Mammoth, so the Water Dogs, obviously, you need to have two goalies for this. One's going to bring up back up Matt DeLuca. Last February, every goalie that went to the event got time in net. I don't think there was a goalie who didn't play. At least, I'm talking at least like a half or even an entire game. You know, they split time for some of the teams, whatever. But everybody kind of brought two goalies and really got a look at all of them. So I think you'll see Rose get some minutes, which will be, you know, it's always fun to see a guy kind of get a shot. Look how it's worked out for Brendan Krebs, who's now a Whipsnakes goalie of the future. His shot came last year for the Archers in the Championship Series. So Rose is the goalie that the Water Dogs went with last summer for training camp. Most teams bring three goalies to camp. Rose was the third for them. And then they kept him around with the team while Dylan Ward finished the NLL season. He was with the team again. I believe Ward had paternity leave or he had a personal leave during the season. Jason Rose joined the team again then. The point we're making is that he is a known to Coach Copeland and to the defense, to the guys in the team. Having a familiarity with your goalie and the goalie already knowing the players, the coach, the style, it's important for this. Your goalie's going to get peppered. Your goalie is going to see a million shots. He's going to let in a lot of goals. A save percentage that's in like the 30s and 40s is like normal. It's not bad at this event. That's how it was last year. So anything you can do to make a netminder's life just a little bit easier like having him not need to meet everybody for the first time when he shows up, that's valuable. Already knowing the staff, the team, that's valuable. The second move, and it got considerably more publicity, as you might expect, California Redwoods, signed Ricky Biazon for the event. Most of the lacrosse world knows Biazon pretty well at this point, but for background for you, just to be thorough here, he was the top lacrosse recruit in his class, basically. He opted to head to Stanford to play football instead. Played linebacker there. He was a captain his senior season there, or his last season. He took a grad year, and he played lacrosse at Virginia last year, mostly serving, spent most of the year basically as like a second midline kind of guy, two-way kind of guy. He had sought a waiver for an additional year for one more season at UVA that I had heard was kind of a long shot, but was maybe a possibility. I think if he, the word was the Pac-12 had maybe, or, whatever that conference is going to be now, had maybe granted it, but the ACC had not, and he was trying to get the ACC to do what the Pac-12 did, or, there's some convoluted thing. I don't want to go down the road because I won't get it all right. Anyway, he sought a waiver for one more year. It was ultimately denied by the NCAA in early November, so that effectively ended his college athletics career. And at that point, he becomes available to the PLL. I think the timeline of it had some people wondering, well, shouldn't he have been drafted? Or couldn't he have been drafted last summer, after his last season at UVA? He could have declared for the draft, but as I said, he was seeking a waiver to try and get one more year. So if he had gotten it, then he goes back to school. Nobody's going to draft him, because if you draft a player who returns to school, you effectively get nothing. You lose the pick, the player's in the draft the next year, and that's that. So nobody kind of took that. Coach Towers does it. He did it with Jeff Teat once. He did it with Levi Anderson last year, where he'll try and maybe grab somebody and then try and see if they'll come out, or convince them to come out. And if they go back, then whatever, it was a fourth round pick or something. So Biazon, I think, could have done that, but when his college athletics career ends, he doesn't have to wait for the draft. He can basically just enter the player pool and become a free agent. So that's basically what happened here. He entered the player pool, and the Redwoods signed him for the championship series. When the series is over, he'll go back to the player pool, and if he excels in sixes, then you can bet that some PLL teams will be interested in him joining for the duration of the regular season in the summer. But the caliber athlete we're talking about here. 6'2", I think he was listed at like 235. Elite speed, like D1 Power 5 conference speed as a linebacker. You're talking about putting him on a smaller field for sixes with those physical gifts. He could be a wrecking ball. He played both ends at UVA. Having seen the format in person last year, the PLL version of sixes, it became very clear to me just how important subbing and transition are in the format. A even minor mistake, and I'm talking like moving a half a yard or so in the wrong direction as you try and sub off in the sub game and in transition, and you're getting punished by Romar Dennis from the logo. That's how the PLL 6's sub game works. It's that precise. Ricky Biazon amplifies that. He makes it even more precise, because let's just do a little hypothetical here. Your team takes a shot and you miss the net. There's no shot back up in sixes. So Ricky goes and he picks up the ball on the end line and he starts running downhill on that field and gets his full speed basically within a few strides. And he's approaching the midline, and a Power 5 conference linebacker with pretty solid stick skills and a very good shot is running at you in the sixes format. There is nobody in the PLL, I mean nobody, who's going to stop him on their own in that situation. And if it takes two people to stop him there so he can give it up, the damage is already done. It's already done. On that Redwoods team, it's already done. Because the other guys in the field there are going to be Ryder Garnsey, Jules Henningberg, Mekhi Montgomery, and Romar Dennis. Good luck. One of them's open. Open with nobody on them. Good luck. So, it's going to be something else. It's going to be something else if you get those kind of scenarios where he can be really involved in the transition game that way and really leverage his physical ability. Heading towards the college game, the IL Top 50 came out, which is their ranking of the top 50 players returning to college this year. Let's just do it off the top. The first rule of putting out a top 50 is that everyone's going to talk specifically about who you rank number 51, the guy you left off. That's really what it's all about. It's almost really what the point is. Quint Kasnick wrote about kind of guys left off for lax all-stars and laid it all out. You should check it out there because he did a really good job of calling out some guys who are worthy of inclusion. But he also did a really good job laying out that it's not like this list really means anything anyway, right? As he writes, it's just like being a preseason All-American. Nobody remembers that. The recognition isn't all that important. So that said, let's go through the exercise anyway because it's fun. It's the point of the list in the first place. Get us talking about who should have been on the lists, who's all those guys that, you know, got snubbed, got left off, got disrespected, or totally getting slept on. That's what we're all about in the lacrosse world, so let's do that. A few of my thoughts kind of as I went through it. One thing I noticed was it was weird to me because IL did the PLL mock draft, like a month ago, 6 weeks ago, however long ago it was, but their mock draft, I think, not only had Lehigh's Scott Cole going in it, I had somebody taking Scott Cole in, like, the first two rounds. And Scott Cole isn't in the IL top 50. Those two things just felt at odds to me. I was like, all right, so we're mock drafting Scott Cole to be a first two-round pick in the PLL draft, but he's not one of the 50 best players in college? You'd think somebody going to be drafted that high would be one of the 50 best players in college, but I guess not. Other things that we sort of noticed, more than half the list is from the ACC or the Big Ten. I think it was like 35 guys. Outside of those two conferences in the Ivy, I think there were 9 players on the list. So 41 guys, I think, were ACC, Big Ten, and Ivy. I'm not here to say that's right or wrong, whatever. I mentioned on the list, I think dropped some of the other conferences from which a total of 4 players came. I didn't want to say that those conferences were being, like, overlooked or disrespected. If you took it that way, it's not exactly... I mean, it's kind of the point, but I think that there's also just... It's interesting to me... I'm just rambling here, but to wonder, is it good for the game if all the top talent basically plays in, like, 2 conferences? Would it be better for the old hashtag grow the game crowd to have that talent or have people more evenly dispersed across the conferences? It's never going to work out that way. It's not like we can, like, assign people here or there. You know, as long as you have the Big Ten is the Big Ten, right? The ACC is the ACC. These are power conferences, whereas, you know, the Patriot League isn't or whatever. So, you know, it's never going to actually go that way. It's just something I wonder about. Would you rather, if you could actually make it go however you wanted it to go, would you try and spread guys out? Or is it better to have them all piled into a couple of conferences? It's not like that's not uncommon in college sports. You know, look, it's not unique to lacrosse. The number of teams in lacrosse is obviously smaller, so the ratio is a little funkier. But the conference breakdown went like that with, again, 30-something, I think 35 players out of the 50 in the ACC or the Big Ten. The criteria for the list, how the IL staff each voted on it, is a mystery. I'm not saying that, like, I can't try and figure it out. I'm saying it, like, they didn't say, and I don't know. So it's not easy to say this player is obviously too high or too low or missing because I don't know what they were basing their vote on. Again, that's part of the point of the whole thing. Because obviously everybody would do it a little bit differently. Nobody is going to have the same 50 as somebody else. I'll say, when I rank players for this kind of exercise, like the top 50 dudes in, the top 10, whatever, I try and do it purely based on the individual player and their ability. Bad units can have really good players on them. It happens. Good units can have guys who maybe are just okay, but kind of get lifted by the fact that they're playing on a loaded offense or a loaded defense. I try to just get into what can this individual bring to the table, what do they do on the field that stands out, that's special, that separates them from everybody else, and how much are they producing statistically, if it's, you know, relevant to kind of look at those things. If Inside Lacrosse did it within the context of like, hey, this guy's good, but man, that offense sucks, so we have to dock him a little bit, that's different than how I do it. So that's why the lists are going to be different. I won't dock a player who's awesome but plays on a bad offense because the guy's awesome and we're ranking awesome players. So let's rank them by how awesome they are as individuals. With that said, I'll throw out a few guys who I would have had in my top 50. Some of them I already mentioned on social, but Bobby Van Buren is a big one for me. I firmly believe whatever year he comes out of college, he'll be the first defender taken in the PLL draft. That could have been the case in each year of his college career, except maybe last year. He spends his weekends matched up on the best attackman in the Big Ten. He always draws top matchup. And, you know, in a lot of cases, he just breaks a smaller attackman over his knee like he's Bane. He's going to be an All-American this year. Mark it down. He wasn't last year because Ohio State's defense as a group really underachieved and underperformed. But he's a monster. And to my earlier point, I'm gonna guess he wasn't in this because Ohio State's team defense really underperformed last year. But Bobby Van Buren is absolutely one of the 50 best players in the country. Other guys I would throw in here are, I'll just call them the Delaware guys, I guess, but first is J.P. Ward. Brennan O'Neill and Ty Kurtz. That's the entire list of players with more points than J.P. Ward last year. J.P. Ward had more than Kirst, more than Schellenberger, more than Dixon, Dordovic, Kavanaugh, whoever you want to go with. And he nearly perfectly spit goals and assists. I think it was 43 and 42 or something like that. Production at that level, you just can't ignore. You just can't. I know it's like, well, he's not playing in the ACC or we're back to the conference thing, but look, he's playing against D1 kids and he's torching everybody. Everybody. So I think a player of his caliber, given that level of production, should be on there. For that same reason, I think he can't ignore Mike Robinson, the other Delaware guy here and Ward's line mate. Robinson is just a lefty goal-scoring machine from Peterborough who torched Team USA at the Fall Classic. I believe he had a hat trick against Team USA at the Fall Classic. He's averaging for his career just a shade under a hat trick a game. He's a two-league pro, indoor-outdoor. He's a national team-level attackman. It's hard to look at his resume and his level of production for as long as he's been at Delaware and say he's not a top 50 guy. I think he's a top 50 guy. I am starting to think I am the leading banner waiver for Levi Anderson. I don't think I care. I'm going to keep doing it. He would have been a first or second round PLL pick a year ago if he was definitely done with college. He's already a first round NLL pick. He plays attack. He plays midfield. Most lacrosse fans, I think, really met him 2 years ago when he gave Yale all they could handle in the NCAA tournament. I think his assist total took a dip a year ago, a pretty serious one. And I think for some reason, hint, maybe it's because he's not on broadcast TV every weekend, everyone kind of stopped appreciating just how good he is. People weren't really tuning into St. Joe's games as much, but he's still really good. He's still, for me, a first two rounds of the PLL draft pick this year. I can't think of too many guys I would want on my team before him. And last guy I'll throw in is AJ Pilot, defender at Army. He has been a starter since his freshman year at close defense at Army. That alone is pretty exceptionally rare. He's also basically been the top defender his entire time there. He's the best player on one of the best defenses in the entire country, and he crushes his matchup every weekend. Defense remains kind of difficult to measure. I think everybody would always kind of love to find a way to quantify a defender's impact on the game. Most times, media folks, we go to the trusty duo of GBs and CTs, ground balls and cause turnovers, and that's how we stack up the defensemen. But you can be an awesome defenseman without crushing those categories. Pilot doesn't necessarily really dominate either one. He had 17 cause turnovers and 35 ground balls a year ago. Both fine. Not jump off the page crazy at you. But you watch him play, and the Patriot League Defensive Player of the Year will jump off the film at you. He's top 50 good. Make no mistake about that. So those are the kind of guys that I thought of first for the top 50, but we don't need to spend too much more time on that. You get the idea. Again, these lists, they all have one purpose: to make us talk the old interactions, all that. There's no award. There's nothing meaningful attached to it. It's keep it fun. Toss the names out. I, of course, as I did that, I'm sure I left out somebody you wanted me to say, and so I thereby opened myself up to the you forgot this guy, you dope, that Inside Lacrosse did. Same thing when they hit publish on it. So by all means, let me have it. The PLL Top 50 is coming out. It's the same kind of thing there. You know, the PLL is going to take the next, whatever, 10 days to slowly drip out a million different graphics and social posts and videos with Kark and all, you know, what'd you think of this guy, that guy, polls, everything in the process of serving a 50-player listicle. And, like, I guess it's fine. To me, it just feels like extremely heavy farming of the social media numbers, but go for it if that's what you want to do, I guess. Yeah, so that's the PLL Top 50. The first, whatever, 10 or so came today. Dane Smith got insulted, and Latrell Harris got insulted. And that's all we'll say about the PLL Top 50 for now, I guess. The other kind of college lacrosse news that we have since we last talked is of the sad variety. Lindenwood announced that following this season, they will be discontinuing their men's lacrosse program. It's one of 10 programs at that school that are being cut this year when their respective seasons end. Horrible news. Absolutely horrible news. Lindenwood went D1 last season. They just got there. They won two games last season. They beat LIU, and I believe they beat Queens, were their two wins. But the program has just come such a long way. And you feel for Jim Lang, their coach, who has been there for all of it. Because they started at MCLA. He was a player who tore it up there in the MCLA days. He graduated, and he immediately joined their coaching staff. He was there when they became an NCAA program and made the move to D2. He was there to help them become a D2 power. He was named the head coach in 2014, and he was there for the team moving to D1. That's him being there for the entire ride, from MCLA into college, to college power at the D2 level, and then up to D1 with the big boys. And that's 20 years. That's two decades. And now that's it. They're ending the team. Two decades of time invested into building that to finally get there and have this happen. So with the PLL skip in the Midwest for home markets and Lindenwood, Lindenwood's in Missouri, if you didn't know, with Lindenwood shuttering the program, it's a really, really rough and sad time, I think, for lacrosse fans in the Midwest. It's tough. To see the situation at the pro level, and then to see one of your new D1 programs, go up in smoke, it's tough. I know there's bigger questions around growth of the game, what causes this, all that. I honestly don't know enough about Lindenwood to say. D1 sports, I know, are expensive. I will say, you know what? Terry Foy put his thoughts on Twitter about this, and I had, you know, my brain was working a little bit the same way, but Terry's smarter than me and knows this stuff better than me. So, but the basic gist was Lindenwood's a private school. Tuition's about 20K. They got 30 NCAA sports. They are all, they have more at the club and then kind of the non-NCAA level, but Lindenwood, with the way they're set up, are a poster child of use sports to get kids to enroll. And if that's the plan for the university, cutting 10 sports doesn't make sense. Back to my brain here, going D1, like I said, is expensive. Football's expensive. Travel's expensive. You know, Lindenwood did have really, really great facilities. This is a place that's invested in athletics. Like, everyone keeps saying the money, but it seems to me like there was money there. And they wouldn't, if the money was a problem, they wouldn't have made the move, right? I did get a tip. Somebody was like, hockey went D2 to D1, and it was actually a massive drain on the budget. I had a hard time kind of squaring that in my mind. Like, hockey is one sport, is a drain enough to kill 10 sports? I also don't think D2 hockey really exists. So I don't know where Lindenwood hockey was coming from to go D1, but it's hard to imagine the math problem to go D1 being done so poorly by an athletic department that they made a 10-sport mistake. There's something going on here. I don't understand it. I'm not smart enough and plugged in enough to to college finance stuff like this to understand it. But any way you slice it, it sucks. It sucks for the players. Apparently already, 20 kids or so from the program have already hit the transfer portal. They'll need to find new homes to continue their lacrosse careers. There's recruits out there who had committed to Lindenwood and suddenly are back to square one. Those recruits, it's brutal to go through that whole process, to feel like you have a home. Finding a college that's the right fit and has room for you and all that, and then to have it just kind of the rug get pulled out. If you're one of those kids, if you coach one of those kids, anything, I would do what I can to try and help you. I'll post your film on social media. I try to do that for any kid who wants it. Anything I can try and do to help you get seen, if you need to get seen, by all means, you can find me. I'm not hard to find, but I feel like you're a victim of something you had nothing to do with, and that's really unfortunate. So I want these kids to have a college experience with lacrosse in it that they find rewarding and that they love. So a lot of players in that situation, too, they come from some of the more non-traditional lacrosse markets. I saw, Pat Arbison does awesome work out in Arizona, building the game out there, helping those guys from that area get seen, get recruited. He had some guys who were set to go to Lindenwood, and now they're looking for homes. I tried to, post and push some film and some transcripts for some of his guys. You want to make sure guys that are from those parts of the lacrosse world are able to get to the next level so that they can represent where they're from. So, you feel for guys like that. Again, if you're in Arizona, or if you're in, a market that's in the Midwest, or if you're in, a place where lacrosse is still really a developing kind of sport and you're having a hard time getting seen, this has just got to be brutal. So, kind of related to this, but St. Rose at the D2 level is closing as a university this year. They had a D2 lacrosse team. That's another batch of players, coaches, educators, commits, looking for a new place to go. It just makes me sad every time I see it. So that's kind of the Lindenwood piece. I hope those guys, again, anything I can do to help those guys out. But last thing, I guess, for today, the NLL is back to the pro level here, but the NLL's back. I had a blast on Friday night. I was watching Halifax and Saskatchewan. They got the season rolling with that first game. Jake Withers is insane. Insane. He tied a single season, or a single game, I should say, loose ball record when he picked up 32 in a game. He had a first half hat trick. He won 31 of 33, I think, faceoffs. Outside of the box score, you see him on the penalty kill, and he's everywhere. On defense, he's everywhere. Halifax didn't even have Randy Stotts. They didn't have Eric Fennell. They scored 17 goals anyway. I thought Halifax, in that game, it's tough if you're a Rush fan, but in that game, I really thought they brought in the season in style with some really exciting play. Obviously, plenty of goals, plenty of highlight stuff. Saskatchewan had plenty of highlights too. Ryan Barnable might have had the goal of the year in the first game of the year. He scores with his back to the goal on a breakaway, falling over before his butt hits the crease, puts it over his shoulder without even seeing the net and puts it in. So that game, I thought, really opened the year in style. I went out to see in person, went out to the barn to see the Riptide and the Wings on Saturday night. I had a really good time at that. The Riptide made a ton of offseason moves. They had a strong draft. Unfortunately, Callum Jones, I think, is hurt, and Jake Stevens is on the draft list. Those are their top two picks, but Jake Stevens on the draft list means he's still in college. He'll join the team after he finishes college. But as the closest team to me, basically, geographically, the Riptide are the team that I get to go see most often, and I try and really plan my winter weekends around who the Riptide are playing. I'll go to see just them because they have plenty of players that are, we'll get to it in a second, that are worth cheering for, but I obviously circle, all right, San Diego's coming east, they're coming to New York, I'm going to see San Diego, because when am I going to get that chance? I go to see Georgia. I had planned on Toronto, but now that's an NLL unboxed game. That's the game that's going to be in Montreal. I think that was going to be a home game for the Riptide, but that's now the Montreal game, so I'll catch that on TV instead. But really, I just love to see the big contenders come to town, see how the Riptide stack up. So, like I said, the Riptide have players that are worth going to see anyway, regardless of who they're playing. Jeff Teed is insane. Jeff Teed is so crazy good. You can't start talking about the Riptide without being like, by the way, Jeff Teed might win the MVP this year. But he really is a special player. I find the Riptide have a lot of guys who are easy to cheer for. I really like watching Connor Kiernan play lacrosse. He's just got fight in him. He's always scrapping. He doesn't take shit from anybody. He's a good goal scorer. You know, he's just a really solid player. Lars Sundown, ton of fun to watch. If you got into the the summer box, you saw a lot of Larson Sundown. He's just a really joyful, like, fun player to watch go end to end. Matt Mourinho is fun to watch. You know, the Riptide made a lot of moves this season. I wanted to see how they shook out. I think the right side of their offense really looked improved to me. I think Kyle Matisse is really good. Obviously, they look much bigger. The Riptide as an entire team looked a lot bigger this year. There's a lot more size out there, but defense looks improved. I think you can say the team looks better than they did last year. So, you know, from a front office on paper point of view, you think they did their job. So, hats off so far. But on Saturday, they basically spotted the Wings 4 goals. It was pretty brutal. And the Riptide spent the rest of the night trying to dig out of the hole. They had chances. They got within a goal. They couldn't quite get over the hump. You know, NLL weekend had plenty of those comebacks going around. Albany's out there. They take their first lead of the game, I think with just a few minutes left in the game, and I think Ty Kurtz's first career goal, and Albany ends up winning. It's a team picked to be near the bottom of the standings, but look, they're 1-0. Rochester goes on an 8-0 run to start the second half, down 10-5 to up 13-5, and they beat Calgary. They hold off a late fight, you know, comeback charge from the Roughnecks. So just a lot of fun games over the weekend. A lot of games that were just exciting to watch, whether you're a field guy, a box guy, whatever. It was just a lot of stuff to enjoy. And I think what I really enjoyed was the fact that it felt like just the previews. Because the Bandits, the Mammoth, the Rock, the Seals, they all haven't played yet. That's the juggernauts. That's the title teams right there. They haven't played a game yet. They start next weekend. So we got that appetizer course was really, really good. But that medium rare ribeye, that hits the table this weekend. Pro lacrosse rules. God, I love it. All right, that's going to be it for today. And that's probably going to be it, honestly, I'll tell you, for the rest of 2023 here. Barring some more massive lacrosse news, obviously we'll jump back on if we get something worthy of its own episode. But there was a minute there for a plan to have a big guest to close the year out. It just didn't work. So we'll tie up the year with a bow, I think, with these last few lacrosse stories. And I'll say that I hope you had a great 2023. I will say as well, if everyone who had this podcast on your old Spotify Wrapped, it stunned me. It blew me away. I couldn't believe it. I really honestly was seriously moved by the fact that there are people out there that listen that much. So thank you so much for tuning in. Thank you so much for spending the year listening to the pod and following the lacrosse world with me. We've got more coming in 2024. More pods, more guests. We've got bigger things happening. We've got a lot of stuff coming down the pipe. So thank you so much for the support this year. I wouldn't be trying to do more and trying to grow this thing more if it weren't for knowing that there are people out there who care about it. So thank you again for that. Enjoy your holiday season. Enjoy your new year, whatever you celebrate. And of course, thank you again for sticking around with me. See you next time.